Welcome to night 17 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Each episode, we bring you the ancient mythologies of the Arabian Nights as reinterpreted by modern authors. This week, we feature the story of the Third Mendicant by Jacqueline Backus and the story of the Mistress of the House by Maggie Lehrman. The stories are famously told by Scheherazade to enrapture the Sultan in a heroic effort to forestall her execution and save her people. In case you need a reminder, Cole the Porter had found himself a guest of three beautiful women who lived in an incredible mansion all by themselves. They partied through the night and were eventually joined by three one-eyed drug dealers, the Mendicants, and then two neighbors who it turned out were really undercover agents. The night took a turn when the mistress of the house started beating her dogs. Gloria began singing a sad song, and the third woman, Erica, revealed scars and marks all over her body and shrieked horribly. When Cole asked what was going on, the mistress pulled a gun on all of the guests and told them to tell their stories before she killed them. The first drug dealer told his tale, and the mistress was so moved by its darkness and all the hardships he had endured that she allowed him to leave, but he refused, insisting he would not leave until his fellow drug dealers had told their stories and earned their freedom as well. Then the second drug dealer told his tale, and it was also so sad that she allowed him to live as well. The third mendicant began his tale and told of how he used to be a king, and how one day when he was out with his royal fleet, the oceans began to fill with dead fish. Before Scheherazade could go any further, however, morning dawned. But the Sultan so badly wanted to know the end of the tale that he allowed Scheherazade to live one more day, so that she may finish her story the following night. And so on the 17th evening, Scheherazade began to tell the Sultan again about the third mendicant and his trials and tribulations.
They arrived by the scores, floating by our vessel. Smell of death, fish tongues wagging, scales and rotting bones. And just beyond that omen, finally, a breeze picked up, and the clouds of fogs lifted and parted to reveal a large, hulking mass of land, just barely in sight. Quite relieved, we adjusted our sails and navigated toward the mass, which seemed to change color from black to white.
"It's Lodestone!"
cried the ship's captain, my very good friend Alistair. And with that utterance, he jumped overboard. When my first mate saw this, he looked up to see the Lodestone, and then he jumped overboard as well. My second mate followed their line of sight, and he jumped overboard. One by one, the superstitious crew looked out and saw the Lodestone and began hoisting themselves over the gunwale. I wondered, what could warrant a death wish by drowning in icy waters full of dead fish? Before the ship's cook could jump overboard, I was able to ask him what Lodestone was.
"Aye, your highness," he muttered. "The Lodestone is a sailor's death sentence. Its mass pulls apart every ship that crosses its path, iron nail by iron nail."
"It's a big magnet, then?"
"Aye, your highness,"
muttered the ship's cook, and as he started to climb over the ship's edge, I stopped him. "How do you know of this? I've never heard of the Lodestone."
"We ship's cooks pass the legend down in case one of us can save the fleets that follow our path," he said. "Legend has it that after a boat has sunk, follow the currents and swim to shore. Climb and summit the mountain of Lodestone. At the top of the mountain you will find a big palace. Break into the palace and you will see a large brass statue of a horseman. With a sword, slice the horseman off his podium and send the statue tumbling into the sea.
Then the Lodestone will lose its powers, and the ocean voyagers hereafter will be spared."
"That's a lot of steps. Are you going to attempt it?"
"I'm tired. Why don't you? You're a king, figure it out, your highness."
And with that, he went overboard. And then I was alone. As a lodestone pulled my ship apart beam by beam, I found myself clutching onto a large and sturdy plank. My fleet sunk entirely and all were lost. I floated there in the ocean as the currents brought me closer to shore. In that time, I heard the voice of God. In my upbringing, my understanding of God had been purely academic. The kings of my forefathers were hardly religious, and yet we studied the patterns of God as though to chart a scientific course for ourselves. We knew of his presence, but we did not actively summon him to us. If he were to cross our path, we would note it as if we would a wild guinea pig or a jackal. When God revealed himself to me as I floated on my plank, I heard him clearly for the first time.
"You can do it, son of the sea," said God. "Summon the mountain, chop off the head of the statue. The waters will rise to meet you at the top of the mountain. Step into the waters. You will soon meet a ship heading back toward your shores, and he will take you back to your kingdom. And there you will live a prosperous life as a king."
"Thank you, God."
"I forgot one thing. You must do this all without thanking me or saying my name."
"Okay."
"Goodbye, Lucy."
"Goodbye, And with that, God was gone. And it all happened thusly. I reached shore, I climbed the mountain, I drank the honey from the honeycomb. I smoothed the stone which opened the passage, which cut through the cave, which led me to the rope ladder, which roped all the way to the palace at the summit. I found the sword, I cut the head off the brass horseman, and as the head tumbled into the sea and the skies darkened, the sea swelled to meet me. I took a dip and came crashing back down. The lodestone was dim without its power. A little fishing dinghy saw me in the water and picked me up. He fed me fish and asked how I was doing. I said, "Better thanks to you and God." And the fisherman's eyes grew strange, and I remembered the deal I had struck and how I broke my word, and I cursed my own forgetfulness as the fisherman threw me back into the sea and boated away. I decided to swim. I have rugged, kingly swimmer's arms, so that wasn't too bad, actually. At one point, I did think I was going to drown, but in that moment, a wave roiled around me and sent me crashing into the shore of a small island. The only people I met on shore seemed rude and suspicious of me, so I stole away and hid in their closets. Several sacks of lentils, lima beans, tubs of butter, cured meats. It was not a bad hiding place. Soon I made my way out of a storage closet and into town. I ambled around the marketplaces and the alleyways and climbed a set of stairs that seemed to call out to me. When I reached the top of the stairs, I found myself in a private bungalow. There, sitting on a couch eating grapes, was a teenage boy who was very alarmed to find me there.
"Whoa, you gotta get out of here," said the teenage boy.
"I know you may not recognize me," I said, immediately humbled by my assumedly wayfaring and dejected appearance. Shipwrecked and closet hiding does a number on the skin and smell. "But I am King Ajib, son of King Kasib. My ship was lost at sea, and I have been through the proverbial ringer. Also, God has turned against me at least one time, so I'd love to use the bathroom if it is so possible. There is nothing to fear."
"You are exactly who I fear."
And he proceeded to tell me about a curse bestowed upon him as a young child.
Apparently, in this curse, his death would be met when a king murdered him on his 15th birthday. That day is today.
He pointed at a cake, half eaten, that said, "Happy birthday, only son." I felt very sad. I was a nice and just king who would never kill a teenager, I told the boy. That the prophecy was all wrong. He felt bad for judging me, and so he let me use the bathroom.
When he returned, we got to talking about our life legacies and current events. He reminded me of myself as a young boy, and I grew wistful. "Would you like some cake?" the boy offered. "That would be lovely." "Help yourself." And as I took the knife up to serve myself a hefty slice, I tripped on a very nice rug. The knife went flying through the air and landed in the boy's heart. He was dead, and I had killed him. I crept out of the bungalow, cursing and weeping. His poor family would find him there and rue me, the curse, its fulfillment. Not knowing where to turn, I climbed a tree and stayed there for many days, watching as vengeful search parties called out my name, ready to take my life for the life that I had taken from them. I wandered the outskirts of the island far and wide. I came upon two beggars, both missing an eye, faces caked with dust, shoes riddled with holes. They were eating the carcass of a ram that had broken its back and died, and the meat smelled very rancid. I felt very bad for them, and I told them so. "I feel very bad for you guys. I thought I had it bad."
"We have it better than you. What the eye seeth not, the heart doth not grieve."
And with that, they seized my arms, they stuffed me into the inside of the ram's carcass, and they said,
"You can be like us too. Your life will be better that way. Or you can emerge from where we send you with your whole self intact. It is your choice."
"Where are you sending me?"
"To a palace with 100 rooms. You can stay as long as you like and open every door you wish, save for one. The last one. It's where we lost our eye. Do as we say, and you will see the way you see now. Do not as we say, and see as we see. But for now, you won't see anything."
And with that, they began to sew the ram's hide up. It was gross in there, a feeling of lifting up, flying, lurching, descending. Later, I discovered that a large stork had carried the ram's body to the steps of the palace. 3 palaces, none of them my own. I sighed and tapped on the big metal knocker. The most beautiful women answered the door, 40 of them. I stayed for a year. I forgot all about the blind guys. I remember a bit of the 100 doors and the last one. The thought of never entering it danced, dimly lit in the back of my mind. The women gave me keys, told me to roam around, and I did. We giggled a lot, ate food together, drank wine. I would open doors to rooms filled with piles of jewels, rooms full of exotic birds, rooms full of talismans, crystals, and stones. Rooms full of other women. Rooms full of baked goods. The last door's presence lingered in the air, but I never ventured all the way to the end of the hall out of self-preservation. It gnawed at me, its presence, a curious reminder of the things I could not have. And then, as I roamed the halls one day, I strode a little further than I ever had before. My feet carried me down a narrow passageway of tile and stone. I turned corner after corner, and finally, I came upon it. The 100th door. And the curiosity got the better of me, and so I opened it. Behind the door was a vicious horse. He snarled at me, gnashed his horse teeth, and kicked at me. And why I was possessed with the impulse to ride him, I do not know. But I saddled him, and strode him, and rode him out the door through the hallways of the palace. The women all rushed behind me, waving goodbye. I told them I would return, and they laughed knowingly. I rode the horse through the palace doors and the palace gates and into the desert. And it was there that the horse threw me. It lashed its tail in my face, and out popped my eye into my hand. And away the horse rode, leaving me alone. So that is how I found myself alone, a beggar, a wanderer, a mendicant. And of course, you may think my terrible misfortune has cast a pall over my life, over my dealings. Once a king, now a poor man, once something, now nothing. But when I think on my life, on the adventure, the stress, the thrill, the velocity with which I was flung into circumstances beyond my control, and I think of now, how I derive pleasure from the smell of butter frying, the promise of morning rain, laughter, a good leg of lamb, the smell of rose water, the night breeze, my lungs breathing, my hands touching, my legs running, my tongue tasting. I do not miss my eye or my former life, my former responsibilities. I have no regrets. I can still dance by the fire. I can still tell a good story. As his voice faded away in sadness and resignation, the mistress stayed silent. By now the sky had warmed and the earliest birds began to rustle in the stately English garden outside. She had dropped the gun on her belly, tapping her fingernails on the platinum settings that held the diamonds in place. The mistress sighed and looked at the other two. "And tell me again, who are you?"
"I'm afraid our story is mercifully short compared to those poor bastards. I'm Jafar. Khalil and I live across the street in the brick house. We just wanted to join the party. Didn't mean no offense to you and yours."
"At this point, I'm too exhausted to be offended." The mistress handed the diamond-encrusted Beretta to Glory and turned on her side, stretching her long limbs in opposite directions. "I'll tell you what. You take the rest of these characters with you and you can all leave. The party's over." Erica began to gather the glasses, the platters, as a group of men shuffled towards the foyer. She avoided Cole's eyes. It had turned into the strangest and most beautiful night of his life, and now it was morning. Gloria shut the door quietly and firmly behind Cole, the last to leave. The red stone pathway glowed with the rays of the rising sun. Cole rubbed his eyes, the creases feeling tight with tiredness. At the gate, Khalil beckoned him and the other three in eye patches, waving a hand at the brick house across the road.
"I think you'll all agree that this was a strange party. I am to get some answers. It's not only my job, but I can't help feeling that those women need our help."
His friend Jafar nodded and started briskly walking to the door, leaving it open for the rest to follow. Cole stood still, unsure, as the others fell into step and walked into the house. He didn't trust this Jafar and his boy Khalil. Cole was no snitch, and they were obviously undercovers. A long breath escaped him. He thought of Erica's lips on his, the way he'd felt about her from the first moment when she'd walked up to him on the street yesterday afternoon. God, it felt like a lifetime ago. He thought of how happy he'd be to do anything, just as long as she was near him. He thought about those bruises on her tender curves, the way she'd screamed when Gloria sang, screamed as if her voice would leave her body forever. She needed him. Cole jogged through the door to the brick house and slammed it shut. Inside, it was almost empty. None of the luxury from the mistress's house. A few cheap wooden tables and chairs stood in the living room. Small TV monitors, listening equipment, a cork board pinned with receipts and headshots took up a wall. Jafar had taken off his jacket and pulled out the tails of his shirt.
"As you guys might have guessed by now, we're CIA. We've had reports of suspicious activity, possibly terrorist in nature, in this neighborhood, specifically centered around that house we just left. Khalil here, he's the brains behind the operation."
Khalil nodded as he set up a fresh pot of coffee.
"Now, we just heard all y'all's stories in there, but I need you to stay here for a bit until we can confirm a few facts. We're also going to bring those women over here for questioning and see if we can figure out where this money is coming from and what the deal is with the dogs and the songs and the beatings. None of this is adding up, so if you four can just make yourselves comfortable over there in the other room, they'd be most appreciated. We'll get some breakfast delivered here shortly." Cole had finished the last bit of his McDonald's hash brown when he heard the mistress's voice. He moved closer to the door, resting his head on the wall next to the door jamb. This'd be straight from the source. And she began. My father owned a fleet of starships, and since the beginnings of the age of the space trade, he had 8 or 9 crossing through the black at all times, running supplies to the colonists on the moon and Mars and collecting the fruits of mining operations on Jupiter and its moons. When he died, he was one of the richest people on Earth. In his will, he split the fortune equally between me and my 2 younger sisters. My mother had died many years before. I remember my mother, but my sisters did not, and I've often wondered if that had something to do with how they turned out. Sometimes the oldest surviving sibling becomes a mother figure for the younger ones, I'm told, but I've never felt particularly maternal. I'm like my father. I work hard, showing my love through dedication and loyalty, and always, always dreaming of the black. Ah, but I see the dawn light now sneaking its way into the palace, and my execution is nearly at hand. I suppose you'll never know what became of the ladies of Baghdad, or Cole the Porter.
But such was the Sultan's desire to hear the end of the story, that he allowed Scheherazade to live for one more day, so that she may finish her tale the following night. The 1001 Nights podcast is produced by Morgan Dubin and me, Nathan Kane. Scheherazade is played by the incredibly talented Ariel Siegel. The story of the Third Mendicant was written by Jacqueline Backus. Jacqueline Backus is a playwright and performer originally from Phoenix, Arizona. Her most recent play, Men on Boats, was a New York Times critic's pick for its Club Thumb Summerworks production, and was selected for the Kilroy's 2015 list. She is the resident playwright for the TRE and a co-founder of Fresh Ground Pepper. The story of the Mistress of the House is written by Maggie Lehrman. To find out more about the stories you heard tonight, the authors who wrote those stories, or the original 1001 Nights tales, visit us online at 1001nightspodcast.com. We had our 1001 Nights podcast annual retreat last weekend, and we went to this wonderful resort on a little island you wouldn't know about. It's kind of a podcast thing. Anyways, it was great.
We giggled a lot, ate food together, drank wine. I would open doors to rooms filled with piles of jewels, rooms full of exotic birds, rooms full of talismans, crystals, and stones.
I opened one door and there was this really mean-looking horse behind it, so I closed it and I quickly left. Not really a horse guy. Alright, that will do it for the 1001 Nights podcast. This has been Night 17. Thank you so much for listening, and good morning.